The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So how many people in the room have read Volume 1 of Capital? Just you can raise your hands. That's great. So it's our goal to convince the rest of you to make it your summer reading project. And contrary to popular belief, it's actually pretty fun to read. It's full of literary allusions, biting wit, and some really profound aha moments that will change the way you look at the world. It will definitely make you a smarter person, also, to get through it. For all of its reputation as an impossibly difficult work, this is what Marx had to say about it in his preface. He said, "With the exception of the section on the form of value, this volume cannot stand accused on the score of difficulty. I assume, of course, a reader who is willing to learn something new and therefore to think for himself. That is, aside from the first couple of chapters, which you really do have to work to get through, all of the book is easily readable and comprehensible. There's no way that we can distill or even survey Capital, so we're just going to try to touch on some of the main concepts as a way to entice you to read it yourselves. I'm going to start with some context, and then we're going to alternate explaining some of the main concepts thereafter. So Volume 1 was published in German in 1867. Volumes 2 and 3 were also published, but not in Marx's lifetime. In fact, they weren't really in any kind of final state. Marx's collaborator, Friedrich Engels, put them together based on unfinished and somewhat fragmented manuscripts and writings. So Volume 1 is the only one that he both wrote and edited. And he did this after he finished work on the manuscripts, or the fragment of manuscripts for the other volumes. So really, Volume 1 is the most mature of the works. It's worth remembering that Marx spent decades of his life working on Capital, which is to say that alongside his revolutionary political activity, which included, you know, the revolutionary wave of 1848, the founding of the First International, he saw the need to devote considerable effort to studying, understanding, and writing about the world he was fighting to change. And that's the same reason that many of us are here for this conference this weekend. So Capital is in part a response to and a critique of the leading economic theories of the late 1700s and early 1800s, which were called political economy. Today, political economy is generally known as classical economics. Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Thomas Malthus, John Stuart Mill, J.B. Say, these are some of the names. The classical economists sought to explain how the new market-based capitalist system, which was not based on hereditary rights and the luxury consumption of a nobility, how this free market system where every individual sought their own gains could lead to a better life for all, an unceasing growth of social prosperity guided by the hidden hand of the market. Now, Marx saw capitalism differently, but throughout Capital, you'll see that he actually respects some of the work of the classical economists. Marx also critiques neoclassical economists, but with contempt for their vulgarization and debasement of economic thought. He saw the neoclassicists as mere apologists for capitalism, who had discarded most of the correct insights that classical economy had developed. So today, when you go to school, if you go to college today and you learn economics, you're learning neoclassical economics. But Marx focuses his critique on classical economics, just to know, like, what is he responding to. So he was not just trying to improve upon political economy or show that the conclusions of the political economists could be improved or corrected. Rather, Capital attacks the very foundations of political economy. His most piercing insights undermine the very assumptions from which classical economy starts, the very categories which are its framework. So, for example, in the second chapter of The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith makes his famous assertion of the propensity in humans to, quote, truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. In effect, Smith is naturalizing capitalism by saying that commodity exchange is somehow essential to human nature. Marx, on the other hand, seeks to understand why do physical objects take on this particular form, commodities? Why do humans exchange them in this particular way? Why is labor connected to value under capitalism? Marx demonstrates that capitalism is not the outcome of human nature or of factors entirely external to human society. Rather, it's a historically specific set of social relations based on the division of society into workers and owners. So Capital is not an economics work in the way that you might think of an economics textbook today, divorced from considerations of the social and political conditions in which the economy operates. It is the beginnings of a comprehensive social critique, an attempt to arm revolutionaries with an understanding of how the system works, the better to overturn it. And Marx actually intended to write a few more volumes beyond the first three, volumes on the state and politics and on foreign trade in the world market. But he started this very ambitious project with an analysis of production under capitalism. And he explains why in his contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, which was published several years prior to Capital. He says, "In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations, which are independent of their will, namely relations of production appropriate to a given stage in the development of their material forces of production. The mode of production of material life conditions the general process of social, political, and intellectual life. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their existence, but their social existence that determines their consciousness." So that's why having an understanding of how production works is essential to understanding the major dynamics of capitalist society. So one last point that I'll finish with here. Capital is not a rant. It's not a series of complaints about inequality and unfairness. It is a scientific inquiry. By that I mean that Marx is trying to find the laws of motion of capitalism and explain how they express themselves in our day-to-day lives. Because there are a variety of surface phenomena, common sense perceptions of things, that conceal the inner workings of capitalism. And I want to use an analogy from science to kind of explain what I'm talking about here. So when you stand on the surface of the Earth, the sun appears to rise in the eastern sky, travel along a high arc, and set in the western sky. It appears that the sun circles the Earth. But further observation and hard scientific investigation led to altogether different conclusions about the motions of the planets and the sun. Perhaps the most common example now looking at economic analysis is that we are paid an hourly wage. For every hour we work, we make some money. So it appears that we are justly compensated for every hour of our labor, right? But that conceals how exploitation works and where profit comes from. Another good example is that most workers voluntarily agree to work for a particular company or employer. So I'm free to work for the company or I'm free not to. You have the appearance of equals on the labor market, capitalists and workers, meeting each other as equals. But that conceals an altogether different power relation. So Marx seeks to penetrate the appearances of our day-to-day lives and discover the underlying laws of motion of capitalism. This doesn't mean that the appearances are fake or unimportant or unreal. But in order to have a complete analysis of how society works, you have to put in the work to get beyond the surface phenomena, find the inner workings, and then based on that, you have to account for and explain how this stuff manifests in our day-to-day life. So in this way, capital is not primarily normative or moral. It doesn't really talk about what should be or what would be better or more just, although Marx talks about that plenty in other places. It is an analysis. So the basis of value, when we talk about value under capitalism, the basis of that is not people's preferences or morals. Marx seeks to understand what capitalist social relations objectively value, despite whatever people wish we would value. And that's all I'm going to say for now. And now I'm going to turn it over to Daphne to begin discussing concepts in capital.
So first, Marx spends a lot of time explaining the commodity, and he goes on about it for a few chapters. And David Harvey says that on your first read, half the time you have, half the time you have no idea what he's talking about. So David Harvey says that. Most people give it up around chapter three, which is too bad, because those first three chapters are the most abstract and confusing, and it gets better after that. Harvey says, as you move on through the book, it becomes clear how these concepts indeed illuminate our world. The commodity might seem like a random place to start. Why not start with labor relation to capital, or the creation of value and surplus value, or class struggle, or wages? Why start with an abstract, confusing, way too detailed dissection of what he calls a material product which assumes mystical characteristics? He explains that the commodity is to the entire system of capitalist production, capitalist relations of production, what the single cell is to the body. He says, in bourgeois society, the commodity form of the product of labor, or value form of the commodity, is the economic cell form. To the superficial observer, the analysis of these forms seems to turn upon minutiae. In fact, it does deal with minutiae, but so similarly does microscopic anatomy. Marx says he's using the commodity to break down the very complex system of capitalist relations of production into its most elemental form, like a scientist with a microscope, but in a social laboratory. So let's take the pencil as an example of a commodity. I like pencils, which is why I chose the pencil. I'll explain more about why later when it's relevant. But suffice it to say right now that in this pencil that looks like nothing more than a pencil that you can hold, use, break, give it to a crying child when they actually calm down and draw, in this pencil there are embodied entire social relations. This pencil was produced by someone, there were previous materials needed for its creation, there were machines, there was labor, someone somewhere made it. And then the pencil was put into boxes, shipped by the supplier, stocked in the store, and finally it was bought by me. That money went back to someone, somewhere, and I now use this pencil. And I can't just look at this pencil and see all that or see what it meant to someone else at some point in the past, but it is all embodied in this pencil nonetheless. The pencil, like other commodities, serves a purpose that is useful. In Marx's terms, it's a use value. I like pencils because you can write or draw with them. They make my handwriting look a little less sloppy, and when it's still too sloppy, I can to read it, I can erase. As you can see, I do that a lot. What I wrote, often with the other end, which has an additional commodity, the eraser. These are all social necessities that make the pencil a useful commodity. All commodities have to have use values. I mean, if they didn't, why would anyone buy them? For example, I jotted down the egg cuber, the headband remote holder, the picnic pants with the attached picnic blanket, or the dual toilet bowls for shared poop time. These inventions didn't succeed because who wants to walk around with a picnic blanket in between their crotch, you know? So there's another purpose also, though, that commodities serve, and that's actually what makes them a commodity and not just another product from another time before capitalism. Commodities need to be exchangeable on the market. Commodity always has two values, a use value and an exchange value. Marx says this: a commodity is, in the first place, a thing that satisfies a human want. In the second place, it is a thing that can be exchanged for another thing. The utility of a thing makes it a use value. The exchange value is, first of all, the ratio, the proportion in which a certain number of use values of one kind can be exchanged for a certain number of use values of another kind. Daily experience shows us that millions upon millions of such exchanges are constantly equating with one another in every kind of use value, even the most diverse and incomparable. If I make a table at home, or a pencil, or I pickle cucumbers in jars, I haven't made a commodity. Only if I plan to take my product to a market and sell it have I made a commodity. A commodity is produced for the purpose of exchange. So if I was a lord and you were all my serfs, I'd tell you to make me some pickles because I do like to eat pickles, and I'd eat those pickles. And since I'm eating them and not selling them, they're not commodities. But if I'm a capitalist and not a pickle-making capitalist, but a pencil-making one, and you're all my workers, I don't have time to task you all with pickling. I need you to make me pencils, which I don't even care about because I never write anything with pencils because I have a secretary who has a laptop. I think about the money that I'm going to make once I sell my pencils. And of course, you certainly don't think about pencils because you're not going home at the end of the day with a crate full of pencils for your own personal use. You want a wage. The question is, though, if pencils are made for exchange, how do you compare a pencil and a pickle? Well, Marx writes, the two things must therefore be equal to a third. In other words, the exchange value expresses something equal between commodities. So I know that if I sell you a box of pencils, you owe me a jar of pickles, because you're the pickle-making capitalist. And because if we didn't know that, then who knows how many pickles you try to get out of me, or pencils you try to get out of me for my love of pickles. Anyway, so the 20 yards, Marx's example is 20 yards of linen equals one coat. So you'll find that a lot in Capital. Anyway, and actually this is where the concept of value is created. Value as we know it didn't exist in pre-capitalist societies that weren't based on exchange. Value is a characteristic that is born with a capitalist system. But how do you measure value? How do you know how many boxes of pencils equals how many jars of pickles? So Marx continues, this common something cannot be either a geometrical, a chemical, or any other natural property of commodities. Such properties claim our attention only insofar as they affect the utility of those commodities, make them use values. But the exchange of commodities is evidently an act characterized by a total abstraction from use value. Then one use value is just as good as another, provided only it be present in sufficient quantity. So, I mean, everybody, for example, knows that bread is more useful than diamonds. But diamonds cost more. And in the case of pickles and pencils, it's really hard to say, because sometimes I really need a pencil, other times I'm hungry, in which case a pickle might be worth more to me. And that would vary the price, right? But and not just very often, but also quite subjectively. So this third comparable measurement has to be quantitative and not qualitative. That's what he's saying. Because that's the only thing, the only way to compare all commodities to each other, regardless of what the commodities are. Remember, all we want to do is make money. So what is the quantitative measure? It can't be weight, again, bread and diamonds, and it can't be size, also, bread and diamonds. This quantitative character is separate from the material, physical nature of the commodity altogether. And what Marx argues is that the measure of the value of commodities is the amount of labor time that each commodity embodies. And actually, at his time, mainstream economists like Smith and Ricardo that Sid mentioned before believed the same. It wasn't a disputed theory like it is today. So why one box of pencils for one jar of pickles? Well, because they took roughly an equal time to produce. Labor time is the quantitative measure of value. 1 hour of labor time, 1 hour of value. More labor time, more value. When they say time is money, they actually mean it. They don't always admit that they mean it, but they do because it's true. And in this light, I think the value of diamonds versus bread begins to make sense. As you can just imagine how many times you can sow and harvest a field of wheat and the time it takes to just dig a mine. Not to mention how much skilled labor goes into the creation of diamonds. And I actually just recently saw a documentary about this father and son that figured out how to synthesize diamonds. And the documentary was like, this could revolutionize the multi-billion dollar industry. And I think what he's actually trying to say is like, this could really devalue the worth of diamonds. Anyway, I mentioned skill because skilled labor is labor that more labor is invested in. That is, it required education. And it is more valuable than unskilled labor, precisely because more labor went into it. And that has to be accounted for. But the way Marx calculates all that is by reducing all labor, all concrete forms of labor, pickling, woodwork, weaving, mining, designing, engineering, to what he calls abstract labor, which is simple unskilled labor. That's a basic measuring unit of all labor. So if 1 hour of the most unskilled labor is worth five times less than the most skilled labor, then the most skilled labor would be calculated, we would calculate every hour as 5 hours. He says, tailoring and weaving, though qualitatively different productive activities, are each a productive expenditure of human brains, nerves, and muscles, and in this sense are human labor. They are but two different modes of expending human labor, but the value of a commodity represents human labor in the abstract, the expenditure of labor in general. So sort of just a silly aside, but when I was a kid, I really liked playing the game SimCity. I don't know if anyone else is of that age. Okay, good. So I don't know if you know this, but they have an app I recently downloaded. I was excited. I thought it would be the same thing, city design. But actually, it's devolved into this horrible, just the worst game ever, Farmville type, wait for products for hours. But I thought one thing that was interesting about it was that there was this global market thingy where you could trade with other miserable gamers, probably all under the age of 13. But and you could sell your commodities that you've made and discover what they're worth that way. And so steel, for example, that would take 60 seconds in the SimCity world would sell at 10 simoleons. But the ice cream sandwich, which that you could make at your fast food restaurant, I discovered that all previous material and labor included takes a whopping 16 hours, real-time hours, to produce. It's a really fun game. And that would sell for 2,560 simoleons. And this is true across the board for all the sim commodities. And it basically proves the labor, accidentally, the labor theory of value, which is that time is worth more. And yes, anyway. You're not going to believe how much the pizza slice costs. So Marx doesn't just leave it at that. It's not just labor time that is the value-adding component of a commodity. As I said, the common sense understanding of that was the common sense understanding of value up to Marx. Marx added another criteria. Labor time, he said, couldn't be measured individually by each producer, but it's measured socially. So you can't really sell an ice cream sandwich for $2,500. It's socially necessary labor time that is the value of a commodity. Marx's words, he says, that which determines the magnitude of the value of any article is the labor time socially necessary for its production. Each individual commodity in this connection is to be considered as an average sample of its class. Commodities, therefore, in each equal quantities of labor in which equal quantities of labor are embodied, or which can be produced in the same time, have the same value. The value of one commodity is to the value of any other, as the labor time necessary for the production of the one is to that necessary for the production of the other. As values, all commodities are only definite masses of congealed labor time. So if I'm a really slow pencil maker, and make my pencils twice as slow as the other pencil makers of the world, I can't get away with charging twice as much, or two jars of pickles. The amount of time it takes to make something depends on the average level of technological development. And if you can be the first to come up with better technology, you might be able to lower prices a little and make more profits for a while. So if everyone else is charging $5, for 20 pencils, and I found out how to make them twice as fast, I could sell them for $2.50, or I could sell them for $4. And this gives me, for a while, a leg up, a larger share of the market, and bigger profits, resulting in more money that I can invest and more that I can produce. Eventually, everyone else catches up, and the value of the commodity is reestablished, and it's lower because it took less time. So the less time things take to be made, the less they're worth. A real-life example, the first Apple Macintosh personal computer adjusted to inflation would cost you today $5,664. Even the most high-tech, expensive MacBook Pro today is about $2,000. And this first Mac personal computer was called a Macintosh 128K because it had 128 kilobytes of memory. And just to put that into perspective, I'm sure you all have that perspective, but this little gadget has 128 gigabytes, so 1 million times more memory. But I didn't pay 1 million times more for it. I only paid $300 for it. And in the Macintosh 128K, you had an alarm clock, a calculator, a notepad, and a puzzle. So very advanced. But then again, when the first iPhone came out, it cost $500 for the 4 gig and $600 for the 8 gig. And now you can buy an iPhone 6 with 16 gig for $200. So even though it's way better now, it costs less. Samsung, this is why, has caught up to Apple's technology with its Galaxy 6, and they're charging $200 and $100 for Galaxy 5. And that's roughly what a smartphone is valued at today. So if computers today are so much more advanced, one might say even more valuable, why do they actually cost less? Why is their exchange value diminished? The answer is that computers today take a lot less time to make. Their parts are made in large-scale factories by unskilled workers who work long hours for little pay. And that's socially determined. I can't go producing computers with less efficient technology or by letting people work slower and get better wages. I need to go as fast as everyone else and pay for my labor as little as I can, otherwise I can't compete within the market. I think that's interesting just because it kind of shows you that value changes in one commodity over time, and it isn't intrinsic to the commodity, but it's socially determined. So what about the value that the capitalists bring in? The capitalists brought in raw materials, machines, tools, like in the case of the pencil capitalists, raw materials such as cedar wood and graphite, other commodities such as brass tips, erasers, paint, and all these machines that I don't know the technical terms for that facilitate the whole process. But all those things have value Why? Because of the labor previously expended on them. That is all called dead labor, labor that happened in the past, but that is transferred into the finished product, the pencil. So the pencil now embodies the dead labor and the living labor, which is labor being expended in the present day that is needed in order to take advantage of the previous labor, right? Because now I'm taking these previous things and I'm making the pencil out of them. And I think it's important to note that the capitalist, if he just had this dead labor on his hands, he can't get any more value, right? He bought something at its value, and now what? It's nothing. It's not gaining any value if it's not being used, and he's actually losing value with every passing day, especially in the case of machines. And in every commodity made, a little bit of that value is transferred, and never again will that value be used. Only labor creates new value by being consumed. But the capitalist paid for the labor too, didn't he? I mean, if you're paid for your labor time, aren't you getting exactly what you're owed? Well, Marx argues that the capitalist found a commodity that creates more value than it's worth. So the worker isn't paid for her time, which we said was the source of value, even though she's often paid hourly. She's paid for her ability to work. She's not paid for the value of that work. Say, for example, you're paid $15 an hour and you work 8 hours. This is a theoretical talk. let's say you're a barista making that, and $4.50 maybe for your coffees, each coffee that you make, and after all expenses paid, the beans, the paper cup, the milk, the espresso machine that's getting worn and torn every time you use it and losing value, within, say, 30 coffees, you've made back what it costs your employer to pay you. How long do 30 coffees sell in the US? Like, how long does that take? Probably less than an hour, probably half an hour, probably less. But anyway, you make that back within the first hour of your shift. So the rest of your shift, the 7 hours, is basically pure profit for the capitalist. That's 7 hours of free labor, or as Marx calls it, surplus labor. All the time that you spent making the coffees that you cover your wages is necessary labor, which the capitalist tries to keep to a minimum by giving you the lowest possible wages he can. Wages cover whatever it takes to get you back to work the next day. So this is what he calls necessary labor, which is the value that we create ourselves that pays for our livelihood. And all the time you spent thereafter in your shift, the capitalist pockets, and that is surplus labor on your part and surplus value for the capitalists. Why does that matter to the working class? I mean, I think it'd be worth remembering this, that labor time matters because it's the creator of value. And that means that the laborers spending their time and labor create the value of commodities, not the machines, not the raw materials, not supply and demand, not even wages, not the capitalist overpricing or underpricing, not the Wall Street tycoons, but the actual labor that the working class provides. We're the creators of value. Without our labor, there could be no making of profits and wealth. And it doesn't just mean that we're the exploited, it also means that we're very powerful. So, I was just talking about exchange value, but obviously I'm not really going to give you a box of pencils for a jar of pickles. So I'm just going to let Sid talk some about money and circulation.
Yeah, so Marx goes on to argue that out of widespread commodity exchange with a large market that has a wide variety of commodities of different sorts, there emerges one commodity that acts as the universal embodiment of exchange value, the way to easily measure the value of any commodity, and that is money, whether as gold or as tokens that represent quantities of gold, so like banknotes or paper currency. Marx doesn't make a historical argument about the origin of money. He says that money is necessary to an economy based on the exchange of commodities. So with the universal measure of value, money, the values of any commodity can quite easily be compared with each other by comparing their prices. If you walk into a supermarket, there is a dazzling array of products, all with their own prices, which seem to indicate that they all have different values relative to each other. The fact that a bag of chips costs $2.50, it seems like something inherent to the chips, as though they're worth $2.50, even though it's not connected with any physical properties of the bag of chips. And all of the commodities have different prices, different relative values compared to each other. And these relationships between the commodities, they seem to get established and change in a way that is completely independent of the producers of the commodities. This is in part the fetish of the commodity, as Marx called it, and it's a pretty important concept in Volume 1. So just to start with, the fetish of the commodity is not fetishism in today's sense of the word, a kind of a sort of unusual or peculiar attraction to the commodities. That may exist, but that's not what Marx is talking about. It's also not just a description of consumeristic thinking, the desire for every latest Apple gadget or the newest jeans or whatever. By fetish, Marx meant it in the religious or mystical sense, the attribution of supernatural or mystical qualities or powers to an object. And by this fantastical attribute, he's referring to exchange value, which, quote, has absolutely no connection with the physical nature of the commodity, end quote, yet which has very real social significance and power. So Marx specifically states that the fetish of the commodity is the phenomenon that social relationships between the producers of commodities are mediated by relationships between things, between the commodities themselves, and that these commodities acquire properties, like price, that appear to be innate to them, but are only relevant in social processes like exchange. So I'm going to dive into this in a little bit more detail because I think it's a useful insight in Capital. So the social relationships that Marx is talking about here are the social division of labor and the process of exchange. He gives an example that the classical economists like to use a lot, the Robinson Crusoe example, that a man stranded on an island all by himself must very carefully know how much time it takes to catch a fish, to repair the shelter, to collect rainwater, and to groom himself. And he has to know all this because he has to carefully calibrate the ratios of all the different expenditures of time to support all of his needs and wants. Now, you take that analogy out to the level of society, and you take all of the commodity producers together, there's a sum total of labor hours that can be performed every day or every year. That labor has to be expended in some proportion on socially useful things in order to have the proper mix of use values produced for society. But how does that work in a capitalist society where commodities are made by private producers without any generally agreed upon plan? Marx uses an example of weavers to kind of ask this question. So let's say that taken together, all of the weavers of society bring 100 tons of linen to the market, expecting to get what they think is the fair market value based on the labor time that they put into that. But let's say they can't find buyers for all of it at that price, and so they have to cut their prices 20% to sell it all. What this means is, quoting from Marx, too great a proportion of the total social labor time has been expended in the form of weaving, and that only 80 tons was really socially necessary, and the rest of the production was wasted labor time from the social standpoint. So therefore, what this example of the weavers, which I think is pretty important, what it illustrates is that socially necessary labor time is not a physical quantity that can be measured by the producers during production. It's not some set number of hours, and you just measure it with a stopwatch and you know what the value of this commodity is. The labor that is socially necessary can only be determined under capitalism at the time of sale in the act of exchange. And in fact, socially necessary labor time is not settled one commodity at a time. It is only determined in the ensemble, the total interaction of market exchanges for the whole variety of commodities. Now, the classical economist would say, this works out pretty well. It's the hidden hand of the market. This is how it works. But Marx sees it as quite anarchic and chaotic, rife with contradictions, tensions, and the possibility of crisis. An economy in which the primary way people relate to each other is as commodity producers, selling and exchanging commodities, an economy on that basis will operate according to exchange value, price, and market forces that dictate production and exchange. And even though these things appear as natural laws or external forces beyond the control of any one person, in reality, they're all specific to capitalism, to this historical form of human social organization. Now, I want to move to how Marx defines capital. Most of us, as working people, we sell one commodity, our labor power, our ability to work. We sell that in order to get money, in order to buy the necessaries of life. So we sell in order to buy. We go from commodity to money back to another commodity that we can use. The circulation of commodities, though, enables and makes necessary another kind of circuit. People who are owners of money, of extra reserves of money, hoards of cash, investment funds, whatever, they can start with money, buy a commodity, and then sell it and get the money back. So you can, you know, money, commodity, money. Now, obviously, there's no qualitative difference between money on the one end and money on the other. A dollar bill is a dollar bill. So the only reason this process would make sense, the only motivation for this process, is if you end with more money at the end. So the circuit that really exists is you start with a sum of money, you get some commodities, then you sell, you do something to the commodities, you sell them, and you get a larger sum of money at the end. This is the general formula for capital: money, commodities, money prime, or money plus a little extra. So what does that mean? It means that capital is value that is undergoing the process of increasing in value. And a couple of things drop out from this way of understanding value. So when you proceed from commodity money back to commodity, you're ending with a use value that will be consumed by the commodity producer. Use values and the consumption of use values have real physical limits. So I can only consume so much bread in a given day. I can only own and wear so many pairs of shoes and all that. On the other hand, when you go from money, commodity, to more money, that does not have any physical limit on it, especially considering that that extra money is usually just thrown right back into another circuit of accumulation. The beginning and end points of MCM, they lie outside the sphere of consumption, and they easily break beyond any physical limits. There are no constraints on the number of zeros on a bank account. Commodity production and circulation, therefore, is no longer for use and consumption. The circulation of money as capital is an end in itself. A second result drops out. What we really have here is the movement of value, which starts in a money form, changes into a commodity form, and changes back into an augmented money form, and then back into the cycle again. While we usually think of capital as money, as like a bank account, Marx says, quote, "Capital is money, capital is commodities." Value is the fundamental actor here, changing forms throughout the circulation, but growing itself through the cycles. This is what Marx called the self-valorization of value, a self-increasing process. Now, the only form in which one can identify the value as having increased is the money form. So money is both the starting and ending point of each self-valorization cycle. And that gets to the next topic that we're going to cover, which is accumulation.
Cool. So far we've talked about creating surplus value, and then Sid basically talked about the cyclical character of that, the capital reinvesting that surplus value to create more surplus value, and you mentioned the expansionary nature of it. So I think the question is the why. Like, why not make $1 million and retire? Marx says, "The capitalist shares with the miser the passion for wealth as wealth. But that which in the miser is a mere idiosyncrasy is in the capitalist the effect of the social mechanism of which he is but one of the wheels." So the capitalist class needs to reproduce itself. Oh, good night.
Wow, man. This is awesome.
Now it turns into a play. Hi. Okay. Where was I? Okay, so the capitalist class needs to regenerate itself by the production process. It's not enough to just make money. What the capitalist class as a class is actually after is not money, but it's social power. And that social power comes from not only having wealth, but putting it into circulation. I can sit on a pile of cash a mile high and say, "I want this and I want that," and I might be able to get all those things if I can buy them. For myself, but to be a capitalist that and have that kind of sway over society, I need to be in charge of some capital, of some part of circulation of money. Otherwise, I'm irrelevant. Does that make sense? Like, the U.S. doesn't go to war for someone who won the lottery. So, moreover, says Marx, the development of capitalist production makes it constantly necessary to keep increasing the amount of the capital laid out in a given industrial undertaking. And competition makes the imminent laws of capitalist production to be felt by each individual capitalist as external coercive laws. It compels him to constantly be extending his capital in order to preserve it, but extend it he cannot except by means of progressive accumulation. Meaning two things. One, if you're Bill Gates at the beginning of the 2000s, you should be worried about Steve Jobs. And basically that if you don't innovate your product, you will lose your market share. And the other thing is that you can't just sit back and relax and let your workers do their work. You need to get the most out of your workers, and you need to constantly innovate your means of production. You want to make the things the fastest that they can be made. And the capitalists don't just want to keep up with each other, they also want to get ahead of each other. Otherwise, they risk losing that share of market. In order to keep that share of market, in other words, you have to actually keep extending that share. So there's two ways, Marx says, that you can accumulate. The first is by when you're expanding production with the existing technology by hiring more workers. And this has the unfortunate effect of giving workers more power as competition between them for jobs is diminished, which means wages go up, which means the rate of exploitation is also diminished. If there's more necessary labor time, more money that's going towards wages, more value going towards wages, there's less unpaid surplus labor time. And the second way to accumulate is by increasing productivity through labor-saving technologies. Of course, this can only happen once a certain amount of previous accumulation has already taken place. And this is the reason that they need to accumulate, because they need to be able to invest in labor-saving technologies. In other words, I can't just decide to find the best, fastest pencil-making technologies. I actually need a lot of capital to pay my nifty pencil-making machine inventors and cover their expenses. So the capitalist class can, in these two ways, actually affect both the demand of labor and the supply. I invest more capital into production. I need more workers. There's more demand for workers. I invest more capital into technology. I need less workers. There's more supply of workers. The capitalist class actually needs the unemployed for just this reason. They need to be able to increase productivity and lower wages, which is only possible if we don't put up any fight. And the more we compete with each other, the less we're likely to fight. If there are desperate people laying around that can be used as scabs, even if we do, we can be replaced, which also explains the tendency to de-skill labor so that we're easily replaceable. What that means is that whilst I accumulate wealth, the rest of you accumulate poverty. I'm going to quote Marx again. He says, "All methods of production of surplus value are at the same time methods of accumulation, and every extension of accumulation becomes conversely a means for the development of those methods, that technology. It follows, therefore, that in proportion as capital accumulates, the situation of his worker, be his payment high or low, must grow worse. Finally, the law which always holds the relative surplus population or industrial reserve army, that's what Marx calls the unemployed, in equilibrium with the extent of energy of accumulation, rivets the worker to capital more firmly than the wedges of Hephaestus held Prometheus to the rock," which is the guy who chopped off Zeus's head, and Zeus is mad about it, so he hired this the god of smiths to chain him, or ordered him. What Marx is saying here is that even if we see some material improvement in the lives of workers, and people argue all the time that we live better today than we did 100 years ago, right? Workers, by producing more and more surplus value for the capitalist class, are producing a capitalist class that is more powerful and more wealthy than ever before. Meanwhile, by giving us just enough to get by in the given conditions of our society, the capitalist class makes sure that we go back to work every day, right? No matter how good a job you do, no one's going to give you $1 million. Basically, you've only earned the right to go back and work again. And we should ask, why do we see any improvement in lifestyle at all? And one part is that we've fought in the past to make things better. And the other part is that at the end of the day, the capitalists need consumers. They need a market. They may have paid you a wage for your necessary labor time by the value that you created, but they only do so in order to get you to come back and give them that part of your labor too by buying their commodities on the market. So they actually get everything at the end of the day. The only problem is the market is only so big. We can only buy so much. If we all made $15 an hour and worked full time, we could still produce much more than they could sell their commodities to us. And this isn't the talk about Marx's theory of crisis, but I will just say as a teaser that there's something a little bit intrinsically possibly wrong with a system where everyone has to produce a growing number of commodities, but there's a limited market. And we don't actually have a talk on crisis this year in the conference, so I recommend going on wearemany.org if you want to hear the next part or more about volume 3. But the point of all this is that Marx is making the basic case that nature doesn't create people with means of production at their disposal on the one hand and people with nothing but their labor to sell on the other. It's not natural, it's not even timeless. There were classless societies. There were class societies with other different social relations. And ruling class capitalists exploiting the labor of workers all over the world for their own benefit is a historical development. And they do it regularly and more so all the time by taking from us the value that we create. And we need to understand that dynamic. So I don't know if you know this, but Lenin taught illiterate workers at the turn of the 20th century, he read Capital to them. And he didn't do that because it was a fun read, which it is. He did that because he was building a revolution. And I think, who's read the Communist Manifesto? Yeah. Well, it's the same author. This is longer. But you know, he goes into a lot of detail. You might want to get a group together to read it, but you certainly can, and you certainly should. It's literally, you know, ammunition for class war.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.